From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing an Arizona case dealing with the insanity defense. Today, we'll have a report on how it could change the way the defense is used in court. The Arizona International Film Festival is this weekend in Tucson. We'll have a preview, and we'll speak with Jeffrey Dvorkin, NPR's ombudsman. He'll be here in Tucson to speak with journalism students at the University of Arizona. Those stories and more coming up, but first. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing an Arizona case. Clark versus Arizona is a new test of the insanity defense. It stems from the 2000 killing of a police officer in Scottsdale. The high court's ruling could set a precedent in how the insanity defense can be used in a court of law. Christopher Conover reports.
Early on the morning of June 21, 2000, Flagstaff police officer Jeffrey Moritz pulled over a truck driven by then 17-year-old Eric Clark. Clark was suffering from what defense attorneys and prosecutors agree was a psychotic episode. He believed aliens had landed and invaded his town, and he shot and killed Officer Moritz. But before the case went to trial, Clark was confined to a mental hospital for 3 years because it was determined that he was not competent to stand trial. When the case eventually did go to trial, Clark's attorneys say they were not allowed to raise the insanity defense due to the way Arizona law is written. In their brief to the Supreme Court, the attorneys say the Due Process Clause of the Constitution's 14th Amendment was violated because Arizona law allows an insanity defense only if the person on trial didn't know the difference between right and wrong at the time of the crime. Tucson defense attorney Gregory Kirkendall says Arizona's law is missing something.
What's missing from Arizona law, according to the defense lawyers and according to the American Psychiatric Association and the others that filed Amici briefs, what's missing is the context of that understanding of right from wrong. That's what's missing from Arizona's definition of insanity law. In other words, what Mr. Clark and his attorneys were limited to doing by virtue of Arizona's law and the judge's ruling about Arizona's law is they were limited to presenting to the jury and arguing to the jury about his mental state only about whether he knew right from wrong. And the jury could not consider, for purposes of determining whether he was insane, the fact that he knew right from wrong within the context of being tortured by aliens.
In 1993, the Arizona legislature changed the law so that a person can be found guilty but insane only if they don't know right from wrong. Randall Howe, who suffers from cerebral palsy, is a lawyer with the Attorney General's office, and he's the one who argued the state's side in front of the Supreme Court. He says, in some ways, this is a state's rights issue.
It's an important case from the state's point of view, because the question is how much control does a state legislature have in determining what their criminal laws are going to be, and if Arizona prevails in the Supreme Court, then that will show that states have a lot of control in this area. If Arizona loses, then that will indicate that states don't have as much control as they otherwise would.
Attorney General Terry Goddard admits the case is a difficult one because Eric Clark thought he was killing aliens.
It is a difficult question, but our law does not allow diminished capacity to be a defense to a charge of murder.
The attorney general says the insanity defense law deals with understanding right and wrong, and that's why Clark was found guilty.
The judge was still convinced that there was some glimmer, albeit perhaps a small one, that he had the knowledge that he'd done something wrong.
If you watch a lot of those courtroom dramas on TV, you see the insanity defense raised a great deal. But the reality is it's not used that often, according to criminal defense attorney Kirkendall.
I've read that in fewer than 1% of cases that are litigated before a jury is an insanity defense even raised, and in about a quarter of those cases is an insanity defense successful.
Legal experts across the country are keeping a close eye on this case, according to Kirkendall.
What experts are hoping for, and folks that are practicing in this area of the law are hoping for, is that the Supreme Court will draw a clear line and explain what the bottom line is for states in terms of drafting their laws regarding insanity.
The court is expected to rule on the case before it adjourns for the summer. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. When we continue, Soo-Yun Lee has a feature story on the Arizona International Film Festival being held this weekend. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The Arizona International Film Festival is being held this weekend in Tucson, and it's expected to draw nearly 10,000 visitors to the Old Pueblo. Soo-Yun Lee has more.
For the next 10 days, Tucson residents will get a chance to see 109 films from all over the world. This is the 15th anniversary of the Arizona International Film Festival.
It started as a very small festival and now has really grown to be regarded as one of the major festivals in the West, and we're getting a lot of attention internationally. It's just become this important, you know, cultural event for Tucson.
Founder and director of the festival, Julio Scalinger.
When we started in Tucson, there were no festivals in Arizona. This is the oldest festival in Arizona. It's the longest running. The first festival took place at the Temple of Music and Art. And it was just a small three-day festival with about, you know, 30 films. And each year, a new component has been added. We discovered very quickly that there was a need to have a Cine Chicano program, since our community is 34% Latino.
About 3 miles south. The borderline is about 3 miles south of San Mateo.
3 years ago, we added a new program called Cine Sin Fronteras, which deals with border issue films. And now, as you know, at this present time, immigration and border issues is the hot topic nationwide.
If someday it, we cannot say.
Scalinger says affordable digital technology changed the landscape of the industry, especially the independent films.
The Sundance Film Festival has played a major role in that. Studios and distributors have seen that independent films can make money, so there has been a major shift in that. But what we feel is important, and again, I think it's why so many of us keep working at it, is that independent film really relates to freedom of expression. And if we look at what's happening in media today, it's controlled by 8 to 10 conglomerates. And when you look at independent films, you really see areas that you are never going to see on network television or in Hollywood films, and that is the importance. For example, we have a film in the festival made by a Belgian filmmaker called Linda and Ali, and it deals with a family in Qatar in the Middle East. The husband is a Qatari and the wife is an American. Strangely enough, they met at the University of Arizona. And it shows how they work out their family issues. And what is so surprising, it's just like any family.
Don't cry now, Hababa.
I don't want to go.
You're going to cry from now until the day you go to school?
I
don't want to go. Just cry right before you go to school.
Don't
torture yourself from now.
Okay, she's still gonna be next to you. Maybe your class is here and her class is here next to you. In the break, she's gonna be with you. She's gonna go wait for you at your class, and you're gonna go eat your lunch and your chips and stuff together.
Oh my God, stop it. Okay, no, I have to go now. I have to go see you.
And, you know, but what we see of the Middle East is just strife and terrorism and all that, so we get a whole different skewed approach. Independent films digs deeper.
Entertainment is one thing. The festival also offers opportunities for emerging filmmakers.
The festival is important for local filmmakers, and we know that because they sort of prepare for it. I mean, that's when they want to debut their work. And the local press has been very good to them, so they get their day in the sun.
Jeff's a highly experienced cameraman from Hollywood, so you want to talk to him.
And just like our Festival in the Schools program, where we try and introduce independent film to young kids, we do the same in our staffing.
We look at all the films that we have.
I teach a class at the University of Arizona where that class gets involved in the running of the festival. Plus other students also get involved on other levels, and so they have a hands-on experience.
Festival goers can watch films in dozens of sites all over Tucson. Half of the screens are located downtown.
I sure as hell ain't deaf.
Folks out there acting like some kind of goddamn circus come to town.
Festival director Skellinger says the 10-day event is bringing in more people every year. People who want to have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
The international films that you'll see at this festival, they're not going to play in theaters, and the chances of them being on DVD or home video or anything else are going to be very slim. You know, people always say, you know, what should I go and see? I just say, take a chance. Go and look at some short films from other countries, or go and look at a political documentary, and just enjoy the experience. And I think people who attend the festival always come back and realize what an important sort of event it is.
What if someday we cannot say a boy was born in Lusk, Wyoming?
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Suyan Lee.
For more information on the Arizona International Film Festival, log on to azmac.org. Up next on Arizona Spotlight, an interview with NPR's Ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Jeffrey Dvorkin will be here in Tucson next week, addressing students at the University of Arizona Department of Journalism. As Ombudsman for National Public Radio, Dvorkin receives over 45,000 emails and thousands more phone calls every year, addressing issues surrounding NPR and its member stations. In a country where there's no shortage of opinions in the media, Dvorkin's job is to make sure NPR pays close attention to the concerns and criticisms from listeners around the country and the world. He joins us now from his studio at NPR in Washington, D.C. Jeffrey, thanks for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
First, can you describe your role within the Organization of National Public Radio?
Well, that's I've been trying to do that for 6 years. Mm-hmm. First of all, the official definition is that I act as the agent for the listener inside NPR, mostly inside NPR News, but occasionally with cultural programs as well. The way it works is that because I am independent of management, even though I do receive a paycheck, whether I want it or not, every 2 weeks, I am free to take the complaints and concerns of the public and choose among them which ones I think require a response. But unlike someone who's in corporate communications or public relations, I don't answer every email. I answer the ones that I think are significant and important and say something about the nature of NPR's programming and NPR's journalism. And what I do is I send that email or that comment to the appropriate journalist, who then is obliged to answer the listener in the first instance. And then if the listener is still unhappy and dissatisfied, then I will look into the complaint and then I will do an adjudication as to whether I think NPR did right or wrong, or whether the impression that the listener had may have been inadequate or not informed in the appropriate way.
Well, you appeared earlier this week on NPR's Talk of the Nation addressing the issue of balance and objectivity in the news. And you said that listeners want reporters to be able to draw some kind of a conclusion. Can you explain that?
Right. I think that increasingly I'm hearing from listeners who say that it's not enough that NPR provides balanced journalism. They would like the reporters to come to a conclusion about some of the important issues of the day. And I think we should be able to do that, but we have to do that very carefully. I think that once we have done solid reporting that's based on the facts, that it's not unreasonable for a reporter to offer a conclusion based on the facts. I think that we have to be very careful about getting into the realm of opinion. NPR and public radio, I think, collectively do a very good job when we are there to provide reliable information. There's a lot of opinion around these days, and there's no shortage of it, and you can find it everywhere on the radio and on television and in print. And I think that one of the things that makes NPR and public radio different is that we're not in the opinion business. We're really in the information business, and the information has to be based on reliable sources and fact-based reporting.
Do you think that a lot of times listeners want to hear their own opinions reflected or maybe validated in reports, and they really don't want to hear both sides of an issue?
Well, sadly, I think this is often the case. What I hear from people often is that they'll hear a point of view on NPR, which is expressed by a politician or an advocate of some sort, and they're outraged because it's not their opinion. And my response to them is that I don't think NPR or public radio should be in the business of providing informational comfort food. Our job is to provide the facts, to do the reporting around those facts, and then to illuminate those facts by a variety of comments and opinions whereby people will say what they think about the issues of the day. And sometimes that's very difficult. Now, we're in a very fractious mood these days in the United States, and people often have little patience for a point of view that they don't agree with.
NPR's coverage of the Arab-Israeli conflict generates a lot of controversy and criticism. How do you respond to those criticisms when you receive them?
First of all, it's an issue that packs a powerful emotional punch. I think that NPR has, in recent years, done a much better job at reporting this story. In the beginning of the Intifada, starting in 2000, I think NPR's reporting was more emotional than perhaps it needed to be, and that it needed to find a way to report this story in a way that was more neutral. But there is no neutrality on this story, and language, the choice of language about how you describe a bomber, is he or she a suicide bomber or a homicide bomber? Even the language around this issue has been weaponized, as it were. It's become part of the argument and part of the anxiety that people have about this story. And I think NPR's challenge was to say, we're going to report this story as clearly and as neutrally as we possibly can. But for many listeners, that wasn't good enough. They want us to be on their side. And more than that, they want NPR to condemn the side that they're not on. And I think that that puts journalists in a difficult position. Our job is not to condemn or condone. Our job is to explain.
And would you say that's also true, the use of language in reporting the illegal immigration issue?
Right. And I know that this has a lot of resonance for many listeners. I got about 300 emails over the last week about NPR's coverage of this. And I think that NPR has tried to do as fair a job as it possibly can, and to use language that isn't that doesn't, you know, carry some implication. So we haven't used the term illegals. We haven't used the term illegal aliens. We've tried to talk about immigrants, immigration, legal and illegal, undocumented workers and documented workers. To me, the issue is whether documentation is there, and that's what the issue seems to be about. Everything else has a certain advocacy role to it, and I'm not, as with the Middle East, I'm not sure that NPR has a position or should have a position on the question of immigration.
Well, we often hear about different news outlets reporting, you know, more of a left-wing point of view or a right-wing point of view. In NPR's case, it's been charged with leaning more to the left. Do you think that is maybe a myth that's been perpetuated by other news organizations, or do you think that there's some truth in that?
Well, there have been a number of studies recently that indicate that NPR is is actually more neutral than some people think it must be. There was a recent study done by two professors, one from the University of Missouri Law School in Columbia, Missouri, and the other and his co-writer from the journalism school at the University of Southern California. And they tracked 18 national journalistic organizations, both in print and in broadcasting, and they put them on a scale of 1 being the most left-wing and 18 being the most right-wing. And NPR, or actually specifically Morning Edition, came down at number 9. Now, there were some quibbles, more than a few, about whether this was an accurate social scientific study, but it kind of gave me the impression that there is something to the fact that NPR is trying to do a job that is straight down the middle. The other thing is that every year for the last 8 years, a polling company called Roper and another polling company called Harris, which is well known, have done surveys on trusted and reliable national institutions. And Harris said that public radio and public television are considered now the most reliable journalistic sources in the country, print or broadcast. And Roper has come up with the same conclusion, looking at a whole range of national institutions, that public radio is number 2, public television is number 3, and the military is number 1. My email tends to go back and forth with people accusing us of being shifting to the right. Most of my emails accuse us of that, and a lot of emails accusing us of being, you know, stooges of Stalin or something equivalent.
NPR has really grown over the years in terms of audience and resources. What makes it stand out and what makes it different from other news outlets?
I think it's because of the level of trust that listeners have, this tremendous sense of loyalty that people have, and frankly, because of the connection that NPR has to the stations. This sense of localism is unique in American journalism, and I think it's a powerful force in making sure that we are here, both at the station level or at NPR or PRI or any of the other public radio organizations, we're here to serve our listeners as citizens of their communities and of the country and of the world.
And why would you say it's important to support your local public radio station?
Because the public radio system it's a unique expression of information and culture, first in America and anywhere else around the world.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Jeffrey Dvorkin will be here in Tucson next week talking with a group of U of A journalism students. He'll also appear on Arizona Illustrated Monday evening at 6:30 and midnight on KUAT Channel 6. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. Here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
Tonight and tomorrow night, with matinees on the weekend, Arts for All Incorporated presents Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the Berger Performing Arts Center. Tomorrow night, the Tucson Playback Theater presents Play with Playback. It's from 7 until 9 at the Center for Expressive Arts. And this Monday night, Ravi Shankar presents the Festival of India 3. It's at Centennial Hall. UAPresents.org has information.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. I'm Julie Burak.